You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey, y'all. Spooky season is here. And if you're looking for a show to whet your appetite for a little haunted history, then I'd like to invite you to check out Southern Gothic, a chart-topping history podcast that explores some of the most infamous legends, folklore, ghost stories, and hauntings of the American South. We've covered all sorts of stuff from the Bell Witch of Tennessee to the disappearance of the Confederate submarine, the H.L. Hunley, not to mention our deep dives into the local lore of some of America's oldest and most haunted cities, like New Orleans, Charleston, and St. Augustine. So, if you're ready for a little good old-fashioned Halloween storytelling with a commitment to quality historical research, then be sure to check out Southern Gothic today. It's available now on all your favorite podcast apps.
Monster House presents.
Today's episode is brought to you by Audible. Audible is offering Monster Talk listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audibletrial.com/monstertalk. And look through their incredible collection for your selection. Download and start listening on your phone, computer, or tablet. That's audibletrial.com/monstertalk. Monster Talk is an independent podcast production of Monster House, LLC. You can show your support by subscribing to our ad-free extended episodes at patreon.com/monstertalk. We want to grow our Monster Talk audience, and the easiest way to accomplish that is for listeners to leave us 5-star reviews on iTunes. Positive reviews have a huge impact and only take a moment.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
We never created a mission statement for Monster Talk, but if there was one, it would have to do with talking about weird stuff and how it intersects with science and critical thinking. Using critical thinking is a skill and one that has to be learned and honed. A case could be made that the very best time to teach critical thinking to people is when they are young, so that they're better prepared to defend their minds against the bad habit of building strong defenses around beliefs that don't stand up to such scrutiny. Better to topple such misconceptions while they are sandcastles and before they're fortified. To that end, we frequently brought on guests that we think would appeal to younger audiences, and this week we're happy to welcome Catherine Hulick, who's written a wonderful book that covers many popular mysteries but brings critical thinking and skepticism to bear on the narratives. If you have a teenager in your life that loves reading and loves weird mysteries, Strange But True needs to be on your shopping list. It covers 10 creepy mysteries ranging from Atlantis to zombies. Karen and I sat down to talk with Catherine about her book, and we hope you enjoy the discussion.
Monster Talk.
Sometimes we do research and write a little bio, and yeah. Then sometimes we say, hey, who are you? Guess which one you're in tonight.
Do I get to describe myself?
Yes. Would you, using yes, only please. Words, how would you describe yourself?
I'm a children's writer and I'm a science writer. So I've been writing for kids about science for over 10 years now. And I've wanted to be a writer since I was a little kid. If you had asked me when I was 8 years old, what do you want to be when you grow up? I would have said an author. So I did follow along that path pretty closely, although I really did start out wanting to write fiction and I wound up writing about science, which I think at this point is way cooler. So I'm happy that I wound up there. Let's see, I write for Muse Magazine and Science News for Students regularly as a journalist. And I also write a lot of educational books about various science topics, but Strange But True, 10 of the World's Greatest Mysteries Explained is my first trade book. So it's my first book that's really mine that, you know, I saw through from beginning to end, and I'm very excited that it's out in the world. It came out this past October.
That's fantastic.
Congratulations. I was going to just comment and say that with your current book, Strange But True, that you've been able to mesh fiction with science.
I have. Yes, yes. That was something I was very excited about with this book, is that I did get to tell some little fictional stories, or not fictional, depending on where you stand on these subjects. At the beginning of each chapter, I really loved being able to, you know, tell some fantastic and magical stories and then go into my science side of my brain and really talk about what might be going on in these stories.
Outstanding. So first of all, I really enjoyed the book, and it's very similar to a project I had been thinking about. And I think this is such a fun idea to do a book called Unsolved Mysteries, but you scratch out the UN. So it's just unsolved mysteries, which is, I mean, to be fair, that's 90% of what our show is just kind of explaining, you know, what's going on. And of course, there's always the mysteries that we don't know the answer to. Those are interesting too.
Right. But,
oh yeah. Just looking for possible explanations.
But you do a fantastic job of introducing critical thinking approaches to these topics, which makes us wonder what inspired you to tackle this kind of material.
Yeah, well, the critical thinking message really is my ulterior motive here, is that I want kids to start, you know, questioning not just these types of mysteries, but everything that they read online, because there's just so much information out there that's being thrown at kids and adults. But kids especially just need the tools to be able to separate what's, you know, possibly real from what's complete bogus. So I really wanted to get kids, you know, with something fun that they're really interested in, to start thinking that way so that they could apply it everywhere in their lives. So yeah, that was one ulterior motive of this book. But I also, you know, what I really wrote it about, who I wrote it for, I wrote it for me as an 8-year-old to a 10-year-old, because when I was that age, I loved magic. I was a total believer in especially psychic powers. I completely believed that I would be Matilda and be able to move things with my mind. And there was another Roald Dahl book that I loved that's less well-known, called The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar, which is also about a young man who learns how to move things with his mind and see without his eyes. And that one was written more like nonfiction, and I thought it was nonfiction. So I really tried to do this. I tried to do what the character in the book does and stare at a candle flame and unlock my secret powers, and it didn't work. But I was not, you know, dissuaded. I kept my belief strong, and I really, at the time, also mistrusted science. I felt like it was going to ruin these mysteries, and I didn't like that there were people out there who were trying to tell me that this can't be real. And I feel very sad for myself now, and I feel sad for any little kid who feels that way, because I now know that that's not what science is doing at all. And I really don't want kids to get that idea about science. I want them to realize that it really makes the world more wonderful and marvelous and deepens the mysteries. It doesn't ruin them at all. Because, I mean, I feel like whenever you answer a question with science, there's like five more that come up. And it really, I think, adds wonder to the world. It doesn't take it away. So that's really the heart of the book to me, is to share that with kids who might be like me, that they love these mysteries but are a little wary about what science might be trying to do.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It can be very difficult to know the difference between nonfiction and fiction.
Yes, at that age. Exactly.
My 4-year-old was flicking through the book, and he just had a wonderful time pointing out the spaceships and the zombies and the haunted houses. But I gather that it's not really aimed at his age group. It's for kids a little bit older.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what the age range is for the book?
I say 10 and up. But really the age I had in mind when I was writing it was a freshman in high school. So I really felt like it was more of a YA book, although the way it looks more middle grade. But and some younger kids have enjoyed it and read it and loved it. But that's who I had in mind. It's pretty high reading level and some pretty creepy stories and difficult concepts in there.
Yeah, there are. I really like the content and the mysteries you chose to tackle. And my daughter's 14. Yeah. Well, I've got two daughters. They're both 15. But the one of them, my little science girl, Sophie, she walked by and saw me reading this, preparing show notes, and she said she wanted to borrow this, but she didn't want to potentially spill something on it if I was going to be using it for the show. And I said, I'll wait till after the show, because you can't have it now. But I think she's very excited about giving it a look. And the fun thing is, one of the topics you tackle in here is the Dyatlov Pass mystery, which my wife was so excited about. She's like, have you heard about this mystery? Like, just like last week. I was like, yeah, baby, of course I have. I mean, that's what we do. But yeah, it is still a great mystery.
Yeah.
And I love how you covered it. This is so fun.
Yeah, well, it's funny today. I was at a book signing event today, and there was like this 8-year-old girl who was, you know, came up to me, and out of nowhere, she's like, yeah, that Dyatlov Pass mystery. She's like, I watched the show on it, and here's all the theories, and here's what I think. And she knew more about it, I think, than I did. I was like, this is not good. I was like, I'm supposed to be the expert here.
It's so hard.
But yeah, no, she was really up on her Dyatlov Pass facts.
Well, so you. It's interesting, though, but you just said that you were kind of doing this as a sort of stealth skepticism project. So, yeah. I mean, I think you did a great job. And I guess how would you describe your approach to making critical thinking fun?
I think my approach is just to enjoy the mysteries. Like, I'm not trying to ruin anything. I'm trying to make them fun, but also like make the exploration of them fun as well. Like, it's not like you have to. You don't have to not believe in it. Science doesn't disbelieve in anything. Like, that's one of the points I make, is that there's always open questions, you know, and at the end of the day, science just gives you different possibilities, and it can tell you one is way more likely than another, but it can never tell you that aliens didn't build the Sphinx, you know, until we could always find a flying saucer crashed there tomorrow. It's probably never going to happen and extremely unlikely to happen. But the fact is that we can't rule it out. So that's one of the things that I say in there, is that, you know, this is not the job of science to believe anything. The whole point is to come up with as many different explanations as possible in the hopes that one of them will turn out to be true.
Nice.
And so you cover 10 stories in the book. Mm-hmm. How did you choose which 10 to write about with your love of these kinds of stories? There are just so many.
My publisher and I worked together. They had some they really wanted me to include. Like, they definitely wanted me to talk about the Bermuda Triangle and Atlantis. And some of those I'm like, well, aren't, you know, haven't we been there, done that? But I, you know, but you know, I really pushed for some of the ones like Dyatlov that are less well known. And I just kind of scoured podcasts and like yours and a lot of other content. You know, I don't know if you know the Mysteries of the Unknown series from back in the 80s, the Time Life series.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I devoured those books as a kid, and I went back and got them all out of the library again and had great fun rereading them. So that helped as well in finding things to talk about. But I also wanted to include some more recent things. So that's why the flight MH370 is in there, because that's a very recent disappearance mm-hmm. that captured a lot of people's imaginations. Mm-hmm. So I really wanted to cover a lot of different parts of the globe and times in history and hit some of the, you know, well-known ones as well as some that are a little lesser known.
Those books had those great commercials where, like, you know, three young men walk into the woods, one uh-huh. floats in the air. What happened next? Read the book. You know, all their commercials like, read the book.
Mystic places?
Uh-huh. It's from Time Life. Talks about things like the Nazca Lines. Were they runways for alien spaceships? And did those aliens interbreed with the ancient Peruvians?
Did they?
Read the book. Read about the medieval warriors who appeared before Stephen Jenkins in 1936. Then he saw them again 38 years later.
Is that true?
Read the book. Read about Aleister Crowley and his bride. They spent a honeymoon night in the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid.
What happened?
Read the book. Read about Cyrus Teed's belief that people live in the center of the earth. Admiral Byrd looked into it. Know what he found?
I know. Read the book.
Read Mystic Places. It's yours free for 10 days.
So how long did it take to put the book together and to do the research and the illustrations?
I actually wrote it in 1 year. So it was pretty fast as far as books go. Because mm-hmm. the opportunity, it was actually the publisher asked me if I would write for them, because they'd read my writing in Muse and really liked it. And so we kind of worked together to come up with this concept, and they wanted it quickly. So I did it quickly, and it was kind of a mad dash, but it was great fun. And I wrote it one chapter, because it's 10 different stories. So it was really like 10 articles. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote them one at a time. So I would, you know, do all the research and write one. And then, you know, I was reviewing drafts of the first chapter I'd written when I was still like writing the last one. So it was kind of crazy like that.
That's always a good way to break it down, though, to just treat them like essays and
absolutely. So behind the scenes kind of question, did they give you any fact checker help or anything like that? Or do you have to do all the research yourself?
I did all the research myself, and I did, you know, send things through my sources to fact check as well. But yeah, I did all my own research. Yeah, but I did include detailed source notes. So hopefully, you know, anyone who's curious about where these facts came from can follow through on, you know, on those in the back and see. I included wherever I could the source material, because I think that's super important.
So how long have you been doing press on your book now?
Since a couple months before it came out. So it came out October 1st, 2019.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I don't want to spoil the book, but do you want to talk a little bit about some of the cases you cover?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we can spoil it. That's all right.
Okay.
It's always good to give some teasers. Yeah, so which one do you want to talk about?
I was just going to say, Catherine was talking about how she's tried to travel the globe as much as possible. And one of the stories that I was particularly interested about was the Monte Cristo homestead, because that's in Australia. And it's in a little town called Junee, which is in the middle of nowhere. It's about 5 hours inland from Sydney. But it's reputed to be Australia's most haunted house. So if you could tell us a little bit about that and how you treat that in the book.
Yeah, well, first I can tell you why I picked that haunted house. I was looking, as I said, I wanted things from around the globe, so I didn't want to pick a haunted house in the U.S. Europe would have been okay, but I really wanted to do the Forbidden City in China, which is supposed to be haunted. But I ran into a problem when I found out that the ghosts there are supposed to be the ghosts of 100 murdered concubines. So I decided that would be a little difficult of a subject for 10-year-olds.
For 8-year-olds.
Yeah. So I had to move on. And so when I was looking for another haunted place to cover, I did come across this mansion in Australia. And I thought, well, Australia, that's not in the book yet. So let's go there. And I did speak with Lawrence Ryan, who grew up in the house. So that was really fun.
I think there are lots of different stories there. And I think, doesn't Lawrence's wife think that she's a reincarnated woman, someone who lived there?
They're actually not married anymore. He was married to someone who had, you know, some medium thing going on. But
claims.
Yeah, when I spoke with him, he said they're not married anymore. He is still leading ghost tours there, though. But yeah, so the house was originally built by the wealthy Crawley family. So this guy, what's his name? Christopher William Crawley. He made a ton of money because he got some foreknowledge about a railway that was going to run through this land. So he bought the land and built a hotel, you know, and just made a ton of money off of people all of a sudden wanting to buy up this land in that town that now had a railway going through it.
That's like a Western plot, isn't it?
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he had 10 kids and, you know, tennis courts and this beautiful mansion and, you know, servants and all this stuff. And a lot of tragic things supposedly happened. Now, I was not really able to corroborate most of this history. It all comes from Lawrence Ryan and like their family tales. I did find, you know, a couple death records of some of the people. So, I mean, all this stuff I'm going to say, who knows if it's actually true or not. It's, you know, it's the mythology around the house. So as the story goes, they had these 10 kids, and one of the deaths he told me about was that the 10th child was dropped down the staircase by her nanny at the age of 18 months old and died. And there are claims that the nanny dropped her on purpose because the nannies were poorly treated. Another death was another young maid who may have been pregnant at the time, was pushed off of a balcony or committed suicide. Another one was there was a young boy, a stable boy, who was badly burned when his mattress was either caught on fire or set on fire, depending who you ask.
Sounds like the Gesley Crumb Tinies from
right. Like, yes. So then he died.
There was seven,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and he died of his burns. So most of these are maids and servants and things that are dying, but the one daughter did die as well. And the Crawley parents also both passed away in the house. William Crawley died when a boil on his neck got infected, and then his wife lived alone in the house for a long time, and then she passed away also in the house, and apparently was like just never left the property.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, all sorts of creepy things that supposedly happened there. And some people believe that that type of thing makes a house more likely to be haunted. And it certainly makes you feel more creeped out when you're there.
I think I've heard different versions of all of those stories. So with the pregnant woman, I've heard that in some cases that she committed suicide, and then in other versions that she was murdered. And I think one of the main reasons for all the stories behind the house and the fact that it's so well known is that it's old by Australian standards. It's a 19th century house, and a lot of houses don't have that kind of a history. So I think that in itself lends itself to being attached to stories of ghosts and legends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Lawrence Ryan told me his family moved in before he was born. His parents bought it. His sisters, I think three of his sisters were there when they first moved in, and it had no running water, no electricity, no running water. It had really fallen into ruin over the decades since the last, you know, the Crawleys died. But he said there were a number of stories from when he was growing up that made them feel like the original residents were still living there. So the first one he told me about was that his parents were going to get building supplies very soon after he bought the house, and they came back and saw light streaming from all the windows, and they thought that squatters had returned because there used to be squatters in the house. But then when they went up to the house, there was no one there, and the lights just had just turned off completely, and there was no electricity. So that's creepy.
Creepy.
Yes. And then there were other stories, like a picture that his dad hung, and then it fell, and then it hung, and he hung it again, and it fell again, and finally when they moved it to the other wall, it stayed. They said they would hear footsteps on the balcony where the maid either committed suicide or was pushed. He told me about a night when he was he doesn't remember this, but he was very young and he was sleeping, and his parents sent his sister to check on him, and she saw an old man sitting at the end of his bed and ran to tell her parents, and when they came back, no one was there. So he told me he always felt like someone was watching him in that room. And then when he got to be a teenager and finally heard the story for the first time, he moved out of the main house into like some back house because he just didn't want to be there anymore.
Wow.
So, yeah. So he definitely believes that there's something in that house. And, you know, that's certainly, you know, when you've grown up with those type of experiences, I can see where that comes from.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. And it's a beautiful house. And it's I think you can actually stay there on the premises.
Yes,
and,
yep.
But I know they run ghost tours.
They do, yeah.
So it's certainly worth visiting.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I have not seen it, unfortunately, but I would love to.
You mentioned before that I have heard people call skeptics fun ruiners.
Right.
And I think it's like, well.
That's just what people have said to you.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I think what I've grown to do is over time, I've learned that I enjoy investigating the mystery, even if it doesn't have an answer. I enjoy taking, you know, as much scientific approach as I can or historical approach as I can. And it kind of doesn't matter if there's not an answer. I love it when there is, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah. I think we've also learned that people experience strange things. And it's like lots of reasons behind that. And you've got them scattered all through your book, which is great.
Well, yeah, we love the folklore.
Yeah, and one of the main things that I took away from this book, especially when I talked to people who were believers, is that even if ghosts aren't real, they're very real to the people who experience them. That, like, it's very possible for people to see ghosts or see sea monsters or see aliens or feel them or hear them or whatever. That doesn't mean they're real, but it is extremely real to the people who have that experience. And that is something that we have to take into account as skeptics, that they are experiencing these things. And that's how cool the brain is, that it does that.
When it's working properly, it can still lead to lots of things. Like faulty memory is actually just memory. I mean,
yeah, exactly. Right. It's how it's supposed to work.
Yeah. And then, I'm going through some of my family's having some mental health issues now, which is unfortunate, but I'm torn because like part of me is like, oh, this is terrible that this relative's going through this. But on the other hand, it's also fascinating. I mean, it really is, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm
still sad, but I'm also paying a lot of attention to what I'm seeing, experiencing with this person and what they're compared to what they see. So it's really fascinating.
Monster Talk.
This episode of Monster Talk is brought to you by Audible. Audible is offering Monster Talk listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audibletrial.com/monstertalk. Browse through their unmatched collection of titles, select one, and download it. It's that easy. That's audibletrial.com/monstertalk. When I decided to run ads for Monster Talk, going with Audible was the easiest choice because I've used it for so long. I've been an Audible member since 2003, and I listen to it all the time. I use Audible to prepare for many episodes of this show. Many of the books that we talk about on Monster Talk are available as Audible selections. My Audible recommendation this week is They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers by Gray Barker. This is a foundational text of UFO lore and introduces the reader to the kind of fandom and amateur academic work of ufology, as well as to the mystery and lore around agencies and mysterious figures who try to suppress UFO news, at least according to Barker. This story will give you a creepy introduction to the world of the Men in Black before those characters spin off to their own series, or at least become a standard part of UFO lore. Barker himself is a strange and enigmatic figure whose work is shaped by his whimsical prankster nature, his awareness that much of the stuff he writes about he didn't believe or couldn't believe, but yet his finances depended upon selling it. and by the secrets about his life that society was not ready to embrace. If you're interested in UFOs, you owe it to yourself to read They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers, and the Audible edition is a great way to consume it. With Audible, I was able to listen while I did chores, mowed the grass, and shopped for groceries. I can move seamlessly from my phone to my tablet to my computer, and Audible keeps up with my progress. You can select any of Audible's titles when you sign up for your 30-day trial membership at audibletrial.com/monstertalk. But I'm happy to make Peter Law's book, The Frighteners, my suggestion for this month. To download your free audiobook while also supporting our show, just go to audibletrial.com/monstertalk and sign up today. That's audibletrial.com/monstertalk.
Monster Talk.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I'd seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww. Yeah.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
Thing done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
Oh, and it's amazing how a lot of things that people can experience with mental health issues can be misconstrued as being paranormal.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Spiritual, all, you know, supernatural. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yep. Yeah.
And well, I don't want to, that's a dark path to go down, but
yeah. Yeah, we'll leave it there.
So instead, let's talk about zombies. Now, let me commend you, because so many books on my shelves go the path of, we're talking about the Haitian style voodoo zombie, and they go down the path of going as far as saying, okay, Wade Davis investigated, it turns out that chemical products can cause zombieism, but you went further and also read the subsequent literature and admit that, like, you know, critical response to Davis's book is, well, actually what was tested didn't really match that, like there's not enough of the toxins. I love the fact that you took it to the next thing and went on to examine how these stories came about. But what I'm curious about, by the way, so let me just say, I love the chapter. You used the term zombie versus zombie. Tell me more about that. How did you come up with that?
Well, I came up with that from Elizabeth McAllister of Wesleyan University. So she was the academic who I interviewed for this chapter, and she's actually the one who collected that zombie bottle that's in the illustration, and that's a real zombie bottle. She collected that in Haiti, and it's one that, you know, a bokor made that to contain a soul of a deceased person. So that's pretty cool. That's the real thing there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, she uses the term zombie with an N, and the reason she does it and the reason I did it is to differentiate it from zombie with MBIE, because it's come to mean such a very different thing in our culture than it means in the Haitian culture. So I really wanted to make it very clear that it's not the same thing, that the zombie with an N is, you know, this is a slave. It's an enslaved person who's been brought back from the dead without their will and trapped, and they're not a danger to anyone. They're just kind of, you know, a sad case of someone who is trapped. Whereas the zombie with an M and a B and I E I E is this like monster that eats brains. So
in movies,
right. Yeah. So that's kind of, you know, that's what it's become in our culture. And it's just such a different thing that I felt like it needed a different word when I talked about the, sure, the historical zombie.
Yeah, that's, it reminded me a little bit, the I think the writer Robert E. Howard, he created a term called Zvimbies, which is pretty much the same thing. Yeah. But yeah, same idea. Just getting away, you absolutely remove yourself from the zombie flesh eating sort of, right, Romero style thing. It's interesting. I like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Although it's funny that we like the word that is the origin of like the original zombie is the Haitian zombie.
Yes.
And I think Romero called his guys ghouls. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm, yet the Romero zombie is like clearly won the meme war, right? Like there's no question that most people,
for some reason.
Right, yeah. Like, it's just, well, I think it's because they're more of an existential threat. The idea that it could be sort of viral or something. I'm not sure. But and there's lots more movies, sure, about, yeah, the sort of supernatural versus Haitian voodoo zombie, the viral, or however you want to approach it. Anyway, I just found it very interesting. Great chapter too. I really like that.
My favorite fact I learned about zombies was that the way to free a zombie is to feed it salt.
Yes, you could have. Yeah, that's the you learned. They covered that in Kolchak the Night Stalker, one of my favorite TV shows.
Yeah,
so they did a great episode of that about zombies. I really like that one.
You never know when that fact will come in handy.
You don't, you know, but you stuff that baby full of salt, sew its mouth shut, you'll be good to go. Yeah. Or I guess alternatively, find the Bokor and have them unsick their dog, basically. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Catherine, you've included some really great skeptical investigator tools in the book as well, like Occam's razor and perception problems and hoaxes and statistics. Can you tell us a little bit about how you included those in the book and what ones you decided to include and how your publisher treated that as well?
Well, actually, my introduction is super important to this book because as we were getting into it, you know, my editor kept pushing the, you know, drama of the stories, and I was getting worried that I was going to, you know, trick kids, that I was going to get them to believe something that isn't true just because I'm making this all dramatic, mm-hmm, and exciting, which is the opposite of what I wanted to do. So I came up with this idea, and my critique group actually helped with this as well, to add this introduction that kind of sets out what this book is going to do, and that, you know, you may be fooled by some of these stories, and that's okay, but I'm going to give you some tools on how to prevent that from happening now and in the future, you know, anything, mm-hmm, else you read. So that's kind of in the introduction. I lay out, you know, here's some examples of things that might be tempting, and here's why, mm-hmm, you don't want to think that way, and here's a way you can think about it. You know, I introduce Occam's razor in there. I introduce the idea of looking into different sources. I introduce the idea of things that could be seem related but aren't. Mm-hmm. So really a lot, there's a lot of stuff packed in there that I'm trying to get kids thinking along the right lines to be able to be skeptical as they read the exciting stories.
Which is really great to reach kids at that age, because I think I wasn't understanding a lot of these concepts. I think I had a natural inbuilt skepticism, uh-huh, but I certainly didn't know what these concepts were and didn't know what these terms were,
right,
until I was really in my late teens or 20s.
Right.
So it's great to introduce kids to these concepts early.
Yeah.
So did you ever consider like inserting like a skeptic checklist or anything like that to sort of make it more procedural, or did you always want to include it as part of the narrative?
Yeah, this was always a kind of a narrative book. I never really thought about, we never had any sort of, you know, anything like that where it would be kind of an activity-based thing. Although when I do events around the book, I do have kids think of a mystery that they've encountered, either someone in their family has told them or, you know, one they've seen on the internet or whatever, and have them come up with a plan to investigate it. So I do have them kind of set up a couple different theories and then go through, you know, what questions could you ask if you were there and what things could you do to test it. So I do have them kind of put these ideas into practice about a mystery that they know about.
Nice.
Great.
Yeah. So that's a lot of fun.
Catherine, what's the reaction been to the book? Because you're talking about going to schools and libraries and doing book signings. How people receive the book?
I've gotten a lot of positive feedback, and from adults as well. I mean, I think every event I've done, there's been one middle-aged man or woman who's, you know, just super into these kind of mysteries and mostly a believer.
Yeah, that would be us.
who just really wants to talk to me. So thankfully they haven't been too creepy, but they've been there. So I've got, you know, the kids reading it, but also adults, which is really fantastic. Mm-hmm. I'm glad I'm reaching a wide audience with it. I haven't had a lot of direct feedback. I haven't got any like letters from readers or anything yet, but I've had I got a picture on Twitter.
That will
yes,
happen.
I hope so. Of a dad, you know, showing his son, you know, he's like, he hasn't left the book, you know, for 3 hours. He's had his nose in it. So it's been cute. You know, I love seeing things like that.
Well, you were wise, in my opinion, that you touch on Bigfoot without doing a Bigfoot chapter.
Yeah.
And you touch on ghosts without like taking on ghosts as a whole. And in general, you've sort of, you didn't do an Amelia Earhart chapter, right? I mean, so in that sense, you've avoided a lot of the sort of subcultures around particular mysteries. And I think maybe that will keep you from some of the hate mail. Mm-hmm. Now, but not every mystery in the book is solved, which I also like. So like the Dyatlov Pass chapter, do you want to talk about that case a little bit?
Sure.
I mean, I know we've never actually covered it on the show.
Oh, okay.
We haven't. Yeah.
So the Dyatlov Pass mystery is a very sad case of 9 young hikers from the Soviet Union who they were very experienced, very, you know, accomplished outdoorsmen and women. And they went on this hike into the, you know, desolate mountains of Siberia and never came back. And people searched for them and found their bodies, and they were in, you know, had various unusual injuries. They were in various states of undress. Some of them were burned. You know, they were in all different places. They had clearly left their tent. It was slashed from the inside. So they had like slashed their way out of their tent and walked off into the snow, and no one knows why. So that's that's
strange.
The mystery. It's absolutely bizarre.
It is. Yeah. And you did a great job.
What are some of the theories for?
Yeah, I mean, there's every theory you can think of. This was originally my first chapter because I was like, well, this covers every paranormal thing ever imagined. Like, some people think it was aliens, some people think it was Yeti, some people think it was, you know, a government conspiracy. Like, it's really anything that anyone's ever imagined. There's a theory about it with this case.
I think it was Amelia Earhart, who has now become a time traveling assassin.
You honestly could that out of place with all the theories I've read about this.
Yeah.
And part of the reason it's so mysterious, I think, is because, you know, this happened during the Soviet Union, and the government kind of, you know, made the investigators kind of wrap up early, so people that like added some intrigue to it. You know, just it being so distant and remote. And let's see, so some of the theories, some of the more reasonable ones are that there was some sort of avalanche that they were fleeing from, although the tent wasn't buried. Okay. So if there was an avalanche, it didn't actually hit the tent, but they may have thought there was one coming. There have been theories about a fire, although they never actually assembled their stove in the tent. And the burns happened because there were some people who tried to build a fire, most likely, when they couldn't find their way back to the tent. And they just might have fallen on the fire when they succumbed to hypothermia. So it probably wasn't a fire that made them leave the tent. It could have been some sort of animal. So that's where the Yeti and Bigfoot ideas come in, is that some sort of animal scared them out of their tent. But they found footprints from the hikers and did not find any footprints from an animal. So that's not very likely to be true. There were glowing orbs sighted in the sky around the time they were on the mountain, although from my research, it seems that it was not the same night. There were missile tests. The Soviet Union was developing new weapons technology. So that is another interesting theory, is that some sort of weapon struck and either scared them out of the tent or caused some of their injuries, because like some of the injuries were, you know, blunt force trauma that could have been caused by some sort of explosion. So that's another interesting possibility, and that leads some people to believe aliens were involved too because of the glowing lights. And then the one that that I deal with towards the end is the one that's in the book. So the book is Dead Mountain by Donnie Eichar.
Yeah.
So he his theory that he comes to, which I thought he did a great job with the book, is that it was infrasounds. So there were these mountains near where they died that had a unique shape, and he really – you know, did his research to figure out that it certainly was possible that the shape of these mountains and wind flowing through them could have made infrasounds, which are sounds that are too low for people to hear. Now, the part where this falls apart for me is that I just couldn't find any convincing research that infrasounds actually drive people crazy.
Yeah.
That's his theory. Yeah.
It's the same problem with Persinger's God helmet stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Theory, it's
exactly.
a great, fun idea, but I just don't think it really holds up under testing. You know.
Right. Right. It's just that, yeah, I just couldn't find convincing research that, I mean, it did convince me that these sounds could have been there, but I just didn't see the connection that these sounds could have actually made these people so afraid that they would leave their tent.
I find it fascinating, but I also, it's the whole thing about people don't understand what happens when we die. There's this whole field of studying decomposition in life forms called taphonomy. Mm-hmm. And it ties into like chupacabra research and lots of other things. I've been doing some of my own experiments on that as well. Just, I'd like to get some of this on film, but the, when you know, the soft body parts will go missing, like the tongue is missing, the lips are missing, mm-hmm. the eyes are missing, the rectum has been cored out or whatever. And it sounds very mysterious and weird.
Yeah.
You know, and then mm-hmm. things about how, well, there was no blood. Well, yeah, because the blood congeals, it goes to the lowest part of the body and lots of other things happen. And because of that ignorance, things that are actually quite mundane can seem horrifically mysterious. And I feel like a mm-hmm. lot of what was going on there, at least with the condition of the bodies,
yes.
seems like it was probably not so mysterious.
Right. And what you're referring
to, people just aren't familiar with that.
Yeah. And what you're referring to is that one of the hikers was found without her tongue. There were others who were, you know, missing some soft parts of their bodies. And from my understanding, that could have been animals feeding on them as well.
Yeah.
So it could be some decomposition or animals feeding. Because I don't know if they were out there long enough to decompose that much, because they weren't, they did find them within a couple weeks.
Right. When I said decomposition, I just mean the disposition would be probably.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So.
But that to me seemed pretty well explained by just animals preying on them. And honestly, what I came to as the most likely explanation is just that some sort of human error happened, that they either had some sort of argument or made a mistake about something, that like they thought an avalanche was coming and it wasn't, or they had a fight, or someone, you know, just someone maybe went outside and just didn't come back, and the rest went to look for that person, and then the others went to look for them. Mm-hmm. You know, you never know. Like, I think it was some sort of human mistake, because one tiny mistake could compound greatly when you're in this kind of situation.
And
it was a very windy night, and they're in, you know, on this slope in this very forbidding landscape. They would have been, you know, within minutes of being outside that tent, just completely hypothermic and making horrible decisions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they call it Dyatlov Pass. They named it after one of the victims,
yes,
right?
Yes, did, yeah. And, yeah, the leader of the group was Dyatlov, yeah.
I never looked to see what the weather was like that night and what the lunar cycle was like. But one time, I went to the Appalachian. Well, I like to say Appalachian, but some people say Appalachian. But anyway, I went to the mountains in Tennessee with some friends, and we made the mistake of miscalculating how long it would be before sunset. Mm-hmm. And so suddenly we found ourselves about 2 miles away from our vehicle, and the sun went down and it was a moonless night. I don't know that I've ever seen darkness to that level outside before.
Yeah.
I mean, you could see the stars, but you literally could not see your hand in front of your face. Like, it was amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Only one of us had a tiny little pathetic flashlight. So you had like 8 people with their hands on the shoulder in front of the person in front of them, walking out through the woods, mm-hmm. relying on like this little AA pathetic flashlight, trying to get back to our car. I was like, I've never traveled without a better flashlight since. Like, so that happened 30 years ago, and I always have a flashlight.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's intense, like how quickly experience outside can go from completely under control to not under control at all. I mean, just a small, you know, mm-hmm. People die every year on Mount Washington in New Hampshire just because they don't know.
Yes.
Because the weather changes so suddenly, and you know they head out with the wrong clothing, or they just, you know, are too confident. Even if they're very experienced, it just happens all the time.
Yep. I have a friend who lives very near there and goes up there a lot and talks about how you can be dead in no time if you're not careful, because you just don't realize. It seems fine. It's a sunny day, and suddenly the temperature drops 40 degrees and you're wearing shorts like a dummy.
Yes.
And then you lose your tongue.
Yes. Yeah. And then you lose and then an animal eats your tongue. Yes.
That's how it happens. That's science.
You treat so many great stories in this book. And as Blake was saying, you kind of touch upon ghosts and Bigfoot, but you do leave a lot of room for other stories that you haven't gone into great detail with. Does this mean that there'll be another volume of the book?
Well, I am working on a sequel right now, but it's not going to be more paranormal stories. It's actually, the connection is that it's also explaining things that are kind of mysterious, but the stories are all science fiction. So I talk about the future. So it's about the future of technology. Okay. So there's stories like, well, you know, about people controlling things with their minds. Then I go into, you know, will this ever be possible and how could it be possible? And what are researchers doing right now that might get us closer to that future? And do we even want this future? That's kind of the key idea of the next book is, you know, what do we actually want our future to be like? This technology book is actually much more in my comfort zone than the paranormal book was, because I've been writing about robots and that kind of thing for far longer than this.
Well, so are you going to be covering like the robot apocalypse, that kind of stuff?
And no, actually, I did want to write a book, and I probably still will, about like doomsday scenarios. But my publisher wanted to go a little more, a little less scary, I guess, which I kids love scary. I don't know why they didn't want it to be that.
Yeah.
I'm still going to write that book, I promise. But I went more in the direction of positive futures that we could have. And then.
I did
address, you know, drawbacks. Like I talk about robot servants and then, you know, will they take all our jobs? And I talk about, you know, mind control technology, but, you know, will the government control our minds? So I do bring up some of the drawbacks of these things, even though they sound pretty cool when you first think about them.
I love all these topics. Yeah. Sounds great.
Yeah.
This is all right up our alley. In our listeners' alley. It's a big wide alley with lots of room. So yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Okay. So obviously we'll link out to your book. Is there anything else you want us to share in the show notes?
Yeah. So you can follow me on Twitter at Kay Hulick. I'm also on Instagram, Catherine_Hulick. And my website's CatherineHulick.com.
Oh, fantastic. Okay. Yeah.
Great.
And this, just so you'll know, this is just bookkeeping. Can you send us a an image you'd like for like a headshot or anything? Okay. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we can also put the book in there, whatever you want.
Yeah, I have some headshots.
And any links, yeah.
Okay. So Karen warned you up ahead of time that we have a standard closing question.
Yes.
All right. Mm-hmm. So here we go. Catherine,
do you want me to do it?
No, if you want to, that's fine.
After that big pause, I thought you wanted me to do it. I'll leave it for you.
Okay. Catherine Hulick, what is your favorite monster?
A dragon.
Oh.
It's not in my book.
What kind of dragons do you like?
Any kind of dragon. And unicorns too, but I don't really consider them monsters. But I just like, you know, the traditional fantasy was my first love.
Oh yeah,
and that's just what I got to go back to. And I had pet lizards as a kid. I had two iguanas.
Oh.
That's the closest I could get to a dragon.
they are amazing. We owe our listeners another episode. We covered the Asian dragons.
Oh yeah,
and we talked about the origin of why. The dragon is like, why do people see dragons all over the world? And it has a lot of cultural reasons, but we haven't actually just gone back and done a straight up European dragons and worms. That's WYRMS in case my listeners didn't hear it, but
but I was a big fan of Anne McCaffrey as a kid. So her dragons are probably the ones that I go back to as, you know, what I think of when I think of a dragon.
Isn't that cool? I mean, I got my daughter to read those. And the whole idea of the thread fall and
it's
like a genetically engineering dragon space problems. It's really fun. It's really fun. So I know there's a lot more of those than I've read though. But
My son's favorite toy at the moment is a dragon. Mm. And I just asked him what's its name and he said Dave. So I don't know where that came from, but Dave the Dragon.
That's funny.
Pretty cool.
Catherine, thank you so much for spending an hour with Monster Talk or thereabouts.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. The book is beautiful. And who did the illustrations?
Yes. Gordy Wright is the illustrator and he did a marvelous job. I just was blown away by every picture. Like every time I saw a new page with art, it's fantastic.
Oh, they're great. It's cool because even the ones where they're referencing a photo, like you're doing Mumler's photos, for example, his illustrations without having the actual photo, clearly you're showing the actual photo. Well done. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just fantastic stuff. Now, it'd be fun. I've got a lot of friends who are archaeologists, so it'd be neat to see what they think about some of his work copying these things. But they're so good. They are so good.
He did a great job.
Yeah.
Beautiful and colorful and great for kids and adults.
I mean, just it's fun, but like the brain scans and.
My son thought those were avocados. And I just let him believe that at this point.
This is great. It's great.
Thank you so much.
Good night, guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Take care.
All right, bye.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard an interview with author Catherine Hulick about her latest book, Strange But True. A link to the book will be in the show notes. Check out our Monster Talk merchandise at monstertalk.org/store, where you can find a variety of cool products to show that you're a next level monster enthusiast. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk theme music is by Pete Stealing Monkeys. As always, thanks for making time for our show and your busy, busy lives.
A Monster House presentation.
Ever experienced deja vu?
Sort of.
Ever experienced deja vu?
Sort of.
Ever experienced deja vu?
Read the book. Sort of.
Ever experienced... Read the book. Deja vu?
Read the book.
Read the book.
Sort of.